Colleagues, dear friends, please take your seats. Distinguished participants, dear colleagues, good afternoon and welcome to our last session and possibly the most pertinent one given our role as parliamentarians, as legislators on the regulating artificial intelligence, the role of national parliaments. My name is Azay Guliyev. I am head of Azerbaijan delegation to the OECPA, as well as the chair of the OECPA Second General Committee on Economic Affairs, Science, Technology, and Environment. It is my honor to moderate this today's afternoon crucial discussions. But before starting, I would like to thank our host, Portuguese Parliament, and our good friend, Paula Cardoso, for excellent organization this conference and for the great hospitality, particularly for the lunch. Today after lunch, it is a bit difficult to, you know, come together, but I hope that our colleagues will join us soon. And also, of course, I want to commend the work has been done by International Secretariat, particularly by the Second Dimension team and Marco Bonabella, Daria, and the other our colleagues. I know that they have put their efforts in order to make this important conference possible. Dear colleagues, today, before the lunch, we have delved into the multifaceted relations between AI and security, examining both the challenges and opportunities that advanced technologies bring to our societies. We have underlined that the AI's potential to improve efficiency, enhance quality of life, and revolutionize various sectors ranging from healthcare to transportation, from finance to education, from public administration to economic development, and from democratic processes to environmental protection. Yet alongside its promise, we also learned that AI presents profound ethical, legal, and societal risks. Concerns about job displacement, algorithmic bias, privacy issues, disinformation, and autonomous weapons are just some noticeable examples which underscore the urgent need for thoughtful and effective regulations. As we stand at the crossroads of AI's development, it is imperative that we as national parliaments play a proactive role in shaping policies that harness the benefits of AI while mitigating its risks. Today, we have the privilege of hearing from esteemed experts who will offer their insights on how national parliaments can effectively regulate AI to enhance security and protect citizens' rights. By the way, before our lunch in the morning, there was a number of questions related to the national regulatory experience and the regulation in the national parliaments. I think we will have a time and a good opportunity to discuss and to get some feedback from audience how your experience is about and how the national parliaments really could bring some added values to the issue that we are going to discuss. Dear colleagues, I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to our three outstanding keynote speakers, Mr. Carlos Zorrito, Member of European Parliament, Ms. Sunang, our daughter, the third Vice Chairperson of the Council of Europe's Committee on Legal Affairs and Human Rights, and Mr. John Whittingdale, Head of the United Kingdom Delegation to the OECPA, for their readiness to inform the deliberations of our Assembly. As we start our discussion, let us keep in mind the profound impact that AI regulation will have on our societies, economies, and democratic values. I encourage all of you to engage in constructive dialogue, sharing ideas and the best practices to ensure that our regulatory frameworks promote innovation, but also protect fundamental rights and uphold the rule of law in the age of artificial intelligence. To conclude, I am pleased to see that the Parliamentary Assembly has become a privileged platform for such crucial conversations. I am particularly honored that the Second General Committee has played a pivotal role in facilitating these discussions, underscoring our dedication to fostering collaboration and understanding across diverse topics. The special debate on artificial intelligence, a technological breakthrough with security implications during the last winter meeting on 22nd February, as well as the recent second committee reports and resolutions adopted as part of the OSCPA annual declarations, serves as a clear testament to this proactive approach in tackling emerging challenges head-on. With these efforts, we have already laid a strong foundation for the continued debate and action on this vital topic. After all, it is the distinct role of the OSCPA Second General Committee to look proactively at what is yet to come, playing a leading role in bringing our society agenda forward, be it on issues related to pollution, climate change, energy security, connectivity, or, as today, artificial intelligence. And always with a special eye to the end users of the OEC product, as our Secretary General often says, our citizens. This is the quotation to our good friend of our Assembly and the Secretary General, Roberto Mantella. The insights shared today will undoubtedly inform our collective understanding and guide our future actions as we navigate the complexities of regulating artificial intelligence. The goal is clear, steering the evaluation of this technology in line with our shared values. Thank you, dear colleagues. Now, I'd like to give the floor to our first guest speaker, Carlo Zorini, a member of the European Parliament. Dr. Carlo Zorini holds a PhD in information management and is a full professor at the Department of Management of the University of Evora. He has held various academic and governmental positions and served as a Member of Parliament in multiple legislatures. Since 2014, he has been a member of the European Parliament, where he currently serves as a full member of the Committee on Industrial Research and Energy and as a substitute member of the Committee on Development. He is also the European Parliament Standing Rapporteur for Humanitarian Aid. So, Dr. Zorino, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, all. Dear President of the OSCPA, my colleague, Portuguese delegation, and my colleague, Paulo Cardoso, dear colleague, Luis Graça, dear moderator and colleagues of panel, dear participants, it's for me a big honor to have this opportunity to participate in this very timely session. To discuss the security challenges in the age of artificial intelligence. Let me tell you that it's also for me very emotional to return to this space. I was elected 9 times in my constituency to the National Parliament, so I have a lot of very good memories from this room, from this house. I will try to combine in my approach, my experience, as co-president of the ACP-UGPA under Samoa Agreement. You know, it's the second bigger GPA in the world with 106 countries, 4 continents, 2 billion people, and before under the Cotonou Agreement, and also my work, as told in my CV, as a co-legislator in the European Parliament in several files linked with the digital transition and the digital decade. You know that with the digital acceleration, we need to deal daily with the challenges of information, misinformation, disinformation. And most important of all, I think, you are now conscious of the finishment or finitude of the humanity, of humankind, not only by a potential nuclear Armageddon or by the destruction of our habitat, our planet, but also by the destruction of our capacity to be ourselves. And I think this is about that you are discussing when we discuss about security, is the possibility to destroy ourselves as with the capability to maintain a viable, just humankind. Generative artificial intelligence is a global opportunity to achieve great and positive goals, but it's also, as you know, a security challenge. at the artificial dimension, it's a risk mainly to repetitive tasks and an opportunity not to do them. So it's an opportunity to find new ways to use our life and our resources. The intelligence part of the equation is a challenge to imagination and creativity. We need to be always 1 second ahead of the machine, because if you stay 1 second behind the machine, we will be dominated by its command and control. And the generative ability is the ultimate challenge, the challenge to be decent and ethical. Because only if we are decent and ethical, we could generate a world that will be ethical and decent also. Because you are creating the languages and the meta-languages. So, let's go to the European Union. The European Union, not having the potential, because there are no agreement to have more own resources and so on, not having the potential for investment and knowledge to lead technologically these domains, tries with the Green Deal and also with the Data Deal. The Data Deal is a name I used to qualify the digital decade. I think it's a data deal. People give your own data, because in European Union the data is property of people and they are a right of privacy, but they give the data to receive in turn best services, best information, more peace, more freedom, and so on. This is the deal, the data deal. So with this Green Deal and Data Deal, the European Union tried to use this soft power of leadership through regulation. The United States leads through engineering and investment. China leads through engineering and investment. European Union leads with some creativity, but mostly try to lead with creativity and regulation. Regulation based in a central idea, the human-centric approach. That is what inspired all the regulation of the data deal or digital package, from data protection, copyright, cybersecurity, digital markets. I was the rapporteur of DMEA, for instance, and the Artificial Intelligence Act. Legislation based on values and on the identification and prevention of systemic risks seeks to become a global standard. You want to provoke a Brussels effect. What we want to provoke a Brussels effect also in this issue. And I can say that in the example of the data protection, in the example of the copyright, is somehow well succeeded. You will see if we could be also well succeeded with artificial intelligence. We see that the United Kingdom is following the same steps. We see that also in the United States, they are following the same steps. Perhaps you can be succeeded with that. Global companies have been induced to act in the European EU, in the European Union, as European companies, and therefore also have advantage in some global regulatory standardization. It's another idea that I want to share with you. Some people say there are no big companies in Europe. It's true. But for me, I have no way to create by a miracle 6 or 7 big six in the European Union. What we need is to put the big six working in the European Union as an European companies. And if they do that, the market in Europe is so strong and so important that they will accept our regulation and also to use our regulation in the global scope is the strategy. Okay, specifically the artificial intelligence regulation was adopted in the final reading of the European Parliament in the plenary in March. This year. The basic idea is the system is regulated according to the risk they pose to users, human-centric, with technological neutrality approach, and the idea that all the systems need to be to have a supervision by persons in control. Human-centric, technologically neutral, people in control. There are the main idea. How? With the risk grading, some things that is unacceptable risk, not acceptable, forbidden, behavior manipulation or vulnerable people or groups. I want also to underline to you that what is difficult is to define vulnerable people. This is very difficult. It's very easy to say manipulation of vulnerable people is forbidden, but where is the border? Vulnerable or not vulnerable? Okay. Social score is also forbidden, the classification of persons based on behavior, socioeconomic status, personal characteristics. But how to work when the algorithms help us to make assessments, performance assessment, which is the border for that, which is the level that is forbidden or not forbidden. The biometric identification and categorization of natural persons, real-time and remote facial recognition, also are forbidden, also are an acceptable risk, but you need to use that, for instance, for law enforcement, preventive or investigative movements. Okay, the rules are very clear. The application is very difficult. After, there are the high risk systems encompassing products, including medical devices, games, toys, management and operation of essential infrastructure, vocational training, employment, access to services, application, interpretation of the law. These high-risk systems have to be assessed before they are authorized and during the life cycles. And the most important in this rule is that the citizens have the right to lodge a complaint against AI systems with the competent authorities. This is the most important of this second kind of systems. About the generative artificial intelligence in particular, we try to address the question of transparency of the rules. It's mandatory to publicize when content is generated by AI. You know how many issues are now with, for instance, the Hollywood and the systems with also the writers, the music composers, and so on, and all of people that have rights of intellectual property. Prevent the generation of illegal content, publish the copyrighted content used for the formation of language models. All of that it's forbidden. So you need to try to have people and creativity, and you can say, okay, brains in control of the new languages. It's not easy, but it's our aim. So national parliaments will be strongly involved in the enforcement of these obligations. It is important that the monitoring and supervision could be made without bias to ensure that the principles of objectivity were applied. I think that the law is good, but it's very difficult to apply. As I said before, more than the letter of the law, it will be the basis of knowledge and ethics underlying the application that will determine the path to where we are going. More than what we write in the law, it's the ethical approach we make applying it. And for that, we need to take in account the differences of perspective, difference of culture, but also the ethical issues, and the national parliaments has a very important role making that happen, because the proximity is higher and the knowledge of people and the proximity is really higher. And finally, I think this is very important, but the law is not enough. We need to mobilize more investment. We need to do more research. We need to train more engineers and architects. Okay. We, in this moment, only is possible to try to lead by regulation, but we need to reduce the gap to the powers that have the capability to do more than us. And we need to involve people to address these challenges. Let me to try to, and this is something, an homage to Luis Graça, this comes from Algarve, but I usually use a very, how you say quadra in English, Luis? Okay, a small poem from António Aleixo, that is a poet from Algarve, and it's in English. It's to lie, to be safe, to reach depth, as to bring to the mix anything of trust. This is very, very interesting. In Portuguese, because perhaps anyone could help me, okay, the interpreters can help me to interpret. A mentira para ser segura.
Well, the lie to be safe and to get deep has to bring to its combination something which is true.
Think about that, which is the level of trust that is need to be trust, which is the level of lie that you need to classify as lie. This is the really, I call that the Aleixo paradox. And if you solve the Aleixo paradox, you can solve a lot of problems that you have to every time. And to solve the Aleixo paradox, we need not only to have the algorithms in Brussels and in the world to try to recognize the disinformation and to cut and to try to manage that, but we need to have every human being need to be someone that is able to make this work, to make this world of interpretation, and to make the difference between trust and lie. And so digital literacy has to be a universal right. Digital literacy is not only digital competences. Digital competences are very important, but it's competence in history, in geography, in philosophy. This is to use that with knowledge, with culture. This is the base. Digital literacy needs to be a universal right. And it's necessary to work on someone that I call a generative vector to eradicate the pandemic of disinformation. As in the pandemic of COVID, we create a generative vector with the vaccines that create the contagion of group and the immunization of group. You need to do the same. You need to create enough number of people with the knowledge to make the difference that it's impossible to propagate the lie. And this is a big challenge, but we need to try to do that. Finally, it's necessary to fight for an intelligent globalization and generate an humanistic spiral. I believe, after to work these last 5 years as the European Parliament rapporteur for humanitarian aid, every day fighting with lack of money, lack of people, with we find some money and some resources with an arithmetical dynamic, but the problems are exponential. And also with my experience to work with these 160 countries from Caraibas, Pacific, Africa, I know that I need to finish. I believe that we need to try to use the Sustainable Development Goals as a base to create human development. Human development and an ethical globalization is the way you have to have a more secure, human, and good to life planet. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zorinho, for your really interesting presentation. And most, you know, if you summarize what you have said, is that we have to have really the human-centered approach when we are dealing with the security and the implications of the AI and many other issues. But I hope that you will have some questions from our distinguished members. Now I'd like to give the floor to our second guest speaker, who is Madam Sunna Avar's daughter. She holds a Master of Laws degree in international human rights and currently is a member of the Pride Party in the Icelandic Parliament. The focus of her parliamentary work has been the advancement of human rights, the protection of civil liberties, and the fight against corruption. Among many different roles, Ms. Suna serves as a deputy chairperson of the Committee of Economic Affairs and Trade in the Parliament of Iceland, as well as a chairperson of the Subcommittee on Artificial Intelligence and Human Rights at the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. So, Madam Averstotter, you have the floor.
Okay. And they're working now. Honored colleagues, as a rapporteur of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe's opinion on the draft Framework Convention on Artificial Intelligence, Human Rights, Democracy, and the Rule of Law, I know it's a mouthful, it's my great honor to tell you a bit about the convention and why it's significant for our topic today. This draft framework convention will become the first ever international treaty on artificial intelligence. It is based on the Council of Europe's standards on human rights, democracy, and the rule of law, which are commonly shared by the non-member states and the non-European states that participated in the negotiations and will hopefully sign and ratify the framework convention in September once it will be opened for signatures. The fact that the first international treaty regulating AI will be based on human rights approach and the acquis of the Council of Europe must be acknowledged as a very important achievement for the Council of Europe and as a sign of its global leadership in setting standards in emerging areas. Its added value will indeed be its global reach, bringing together states from all over the world wishing to address the global challenges posed by AI from the perspective of these values, and with a view to mitigating or limiting its risks. Another significant added value of the Convention is that it's not only intended to protect human rights in the context of AI, but also the two other core values of the Council of Europe, namely democracy and the rule of law. Chapter 1 of the draft Framework Convention contains general provisions, such as the object and purpose of the Framework Convention, the definition of artificial intelligence systems for the purpose of the Convention, and its scope of application, Article 3, which, as I will come to later, is also its most controversial article, the scope. Now, as regards to the scope, Article 3.1a obliges each party to, and I quote, apply the convention to the activities within the life cycle of artificial intelligence systems undertaken by public authorities or private parties acting on their behalf. Article 3.1b obliges all parties to address risks and impacts arising from activities within the life cycle of artificial intelligence systems by private actors to the extent not covered in the subparagraph A, in a manner conforming with the object and purpose of the convention. Now, this approach to differing between private and public actors was hotly debated and was the item of much negotiation power throughout the negotiations and ended up being this distinguishment between the two. And this is one of the criticisms that the assembly that I represent brought forward, that we shouldn't distinguish between public and private actors because the risks that they pose to the rights of individuals are equal. But I'll come more to that later. Chapter 2 contains two provisions enshrining general obligations on the protection of human rights, that's Article 4, and on the integrity of democratic processes and respect for the rule of law, and that's Article 5. Chapter 3 lays down general common principles that each party shall implement in regard to artificial intelligence systems, and these include human dignity and individual autonomy, transparency and oversight, accountability and responsibility, equality and non-discrimination, privacy and data protection, reliability, and safe innovation. Chapter 4 regulates remedies and procedural guarantees. Remedies for violation of human rights resulting from these activities within the life cycle of AI systems must be accessible and effective. Effective procedural guarantees shall be available where an AI system significantly impacts the enjoyment of human rights. Chapter 5 contains a unique and dedicated provision on risk and impact management framework, obliging the parties to identify, assess, prevent, and mitigate risks posed by artificial intelligence systems by considering actual and potential impacts to human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. Chapter 6 is on the implementation of the convention, and 7 contains provisions on the follow-up mechanism and cooperation. Now, as to the follow-up mechanism, it is hoped that it will facilitate the implementation of a reporting obligation by the first states having ratified the convention, and they will need to present their first report within the first 2 years after becoming a party. The reporting obligation enshrined will be the key to the interpretation, implementation, and development of the convention. Now, the conference of the parties will have the power to identify problems in the use and implementation of the convention, make proposals for amendments, and formulate its opinion on any amendment proposals. They can express specific recommendations on any question concerning the interpretation or application of the treaty, and facilitate the exchange of information, friendly settlement of disputes, and cooperation with relevant stakeholders. But perhaps the most problematic aspect, so that I turn to some negative points of the convention, is its restricted scope of application, as I addressed before, with a system that we in the Assembly call à la carte, where you can choose how you treat private actors. You just have to declare how you choose to treat private actors with regard to private actors, and with blanket exceptions on national security and defense. In its past resolutions, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe considered that private actors should fall within the scope of such a legally binding instrument, recalling that in its AI reports, the Assembly considers self-regulatory principles introduced by private actors not sufficient to adequately protect human rights. It is also the view of the Assembly that the final compromise on the public-private sectors should not be used, and we should not allow our member states of the Council of Europe to use this exception as a module to dilute the application of the Convention, the European Convention of Human Rights, to private actors operating within their jurisdiction. Parties to the European Convention of Human Rights should therefore fully apply the Convention provisions to private actors when submitting their declarations according to Article 3.1. The Conference of the Parties to the Framework Convention should also be invited to fully use its powers and reporting system to assess how parties apply the Convention to private actors and to provide guidance in its interpretation and effective application. Turning now to national defense, let me also say that while the Statute of the Council of Europe excludes matters relating to national defense, interferences with human rights resulting from military activities are not outside the scope of human rights treaties, including the European Convention on Human Rights. The Assembly has, in fact, adopted a report on the use of AI within the area of defense and lethal force, namely the use of AI in ongoing armed conflict, the use of autonomous weapon systems, because the use of AI in ongoing armed conflicts raises serious concern with regards to international humanitarian law and human rights law. It is also the Assembly's position that if the Framework Convention is applied mainly to public entities, the exemptions regarding AI uses for national security and defense purposes risk narrowing even more the scope of application and calling into question its transversal nature. Because let me be very clear on this. The personal integrity, human dignity, and human rights of our citizens should be seen as the most pressing security concern, not the ability of states or governments to spy on their citizens without restriction or oversight. Finally, let me conclude with some missed opportunities within the draft framework convention, or as we politicians might phrase it, opportunities for growth. What I miss in the convention are specific provisions on the positive uses of artificial intelligence. Although there are incidental references to the benefits or positive effects of AI, there are no specific obligations on how to use the potential of AI for improving democracy, good governance, and the protection of human rights. Furthermore, the development of human rights in relation to the advancements in neurotechnology addressed earlier today is still an opportunity for growth. The Assembly has addressed the huge potential benefits of neurotechnology, especially in the medical field, while stressing the unique and unprecedented threats to fundamental values of human rights and dignity that brain-computer interfaces, or BCI, may pose. BCI technology should be developed with respect for human rights and dignity. It should be safe. It should not be used against the subject's will or in a way that prevents the subject from acting freely and being responsible for their actions. And it should not create a privileged status for its users. The Assembly therefore called on member states to establish ethical and legal frameworks for research, development, and application of BCI technology, and to consider the establishment of new neuro rights, such as cognitive liberty, mental privacy, mental integrity, and psychological continuity. But this was not addressed in the Framework Convention. Finally, the draft Framework Convention does not address ownership of AI. The concentration of power and wealth in the hands of very few tech giants in the face of weakened workers' rights and the ability to enforce these rights through strikes. It doesn't address the bleak future where inequality will be so absolute between the very few super-rich Jeff Bezoses of this world and then the rest of us, powerless and useless, if we do not address ownership of AI. Now, while the Framework Convention did not address these issues, we still have opportunity to grow in these areas. And I would say to end that we as parliamentarians must ensure that these opportunities will not be missed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Sunna, our daughter, for your interesting presentation. You have touched upon many interesting things, and that really needs to be discussed. And of course, I hope that our colleagues will raise this issue, and then we will come up later on to that point. Now, I'd like to give the floor to our friend and the colleague, Mr. John Whittingdale, who is the head of the United Kingdom delegation to the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly. He was formerly the Assembly's Special Rapporteur on War Crimes in Ukraine. He is also a member of the Assembly's Standing Committee, Rules Committee, and the Committee on Political Affairs and Security. Sir Whittingdale holds a degree in economics and has served in multiple different roles in the UK government and the Parliament throughout his career. He was a chairman of the British group. He deserves to be presented well. British group of the Inter-Parliamentary Union, as well as a chairman of the all-party parliamentary groups for Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. In 2020, Sir John was a minister for media and data. He is very relative to the topic. So he was also appointed Minister of State jointly in the Department for Culture, Media and Sport and the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology in 2023. So, John, you have the floor.
Please. Well, Jose, thank you for that introduction. Of all the things, perhaps the element which is most relevant is that I took a break from leading the UK delegation to OSCEPA to return to the British government, where I was minister in the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology at the time of our first AI safety summit, which took place last year. And of course, that is now going to be followed up tomorrow by the second summit, which is taking place in South Korea. I wanted just to put some of this into context a little bit. In some ways, AI represents a revolutionary leap forward, but just as the combustion engine did, or computers did, or indeed the internet. The power of particularly generative AI is extraordinary, and rightly, as parliamentarians, we focus on what needs to be done to ensure that it isn't abused, but we should always remember that the benefits are massive. We heard a little bit earlier about healthcare, but in education, in climate change, and in economic productivity, it is going to be transformational and largely to our benefit. Now, when we set out about 2 years ago to look at how we should regulate it, I very much follow my colleague who spoke earlier, his view about regulation. There are two problems with regulation. We have just passed legislation to put in place safety measures for people going online on the internet and to try and promote competition in the digital markets. It's taken us, I think, 5-6 years to do that. And the problem with regulation is that you are dealing with a technology that is moving so rapidly that by the time you've legislated, actually, it's completely out of date. And the second difficulty is that regulation can stifle innovation, and a lot of the most exciting developments are ones that we are all completely unaware of. It won't be until somebody in a small room somewhere comes up with a bright idea. So what we tried to do was to put in place principles. They're ones which nobody would argue with. The five basic principles are safety, transparency, fairness, accountability, and contestability. And then, rather than try and impose that through a single mechanism, we have a number of regulators, each of which deals with a particular area, and in each case, they are developing measures to take account of the use of AI in their sectors. So I'm talking about things like the Competition Agency, the Data Protection Office, the Medicines Regulator, the Food Standards Agency, and each one is focusing on what needs to be done to encourage innovation in AI, but also to make sure that it is properly used. And that is then overseen by a central body in the government. Now, the issue of safety, which is one which we particularly focused on, is one that, as I say, the global summits have addressed, but those have not just been attended by governments. We were very clear that at Bletchley, and indeed now at Seoul, the big tech companies had to be there. And a lot of the designs to ensure safety are going to be responsible for them. So, you know, each of the big companies will have red teams. Red teams are those which are, they set out to abuse, to find the flaws, to use it improperly, and then having identified how they can be abused, they then work out how to stop the red teams from doing it. So it's an exercise which is very effective in trying to put in place what we've called guardrails, which are the measures to ensure that AI is directed and focused in a positive way. Now, we've spent some time today on a number of the potential negatives, and I wanted to touch just on a few. The first one, which Mr. Zorino talked about, I was also Minister for Creative Industries. The UK is very strong in creative industries, in music, in writing, in filmmaking, and that depends on copyright. And copyright, traditionally, is very easy to understand. If you sing a song written by somebody else, then you need to give them some recognition and pay them. If you publish a work which was written by somebody else, then you need to give them recognition. AI makes it much more difficult. The concept of text and data mining, where the large language models scrape through billions of pieces of content in order to create an original work, in that it's original because nobody's heard it or seen it before, but actually it's based on the creative content of hundreds, maybe more, people. That is a real challenge, because the creators will say, we are still entitled to some kind of compensation for that, or there needs to be some kind of licensing. But at the moment, a lot of the tech companies are saying, we don't recognize that, we don't see any liability. And that is an area where there is a very active debate and which we are going to have to reach an agreement. And a lot of it may take place through court actions, and there are a number of legal cases currently underway. Irene earlier spoke about the dangers for fraud and corruption. There is no doubt that AI makes fraud a lot more sophisticated. We're all familiar with the idea that you get a text message saying, this is your son, I've been robbed and I haven't got anywhere to go, please send me money to this bank account. And most people are clever enough to know that's probably a scam. If you get a message from your son in your son's voice, then it becomes much more difficult. And the way in which AI can be used to create messages or videos which are almost indistinguishable is also something we need to take seriously. It has many benefits, but of course also it is going to be a very powerful tool for those who wish to disrupt elections. And we've already begun to see how in elections fake news and false videos have been released. So far we've been reasonably successful in spotting them, but each one is more sophisticated than the last. And actually, in my view, one of the answers to that, and I was responsible in government for many years for media, is actually support for traditional public service media, who will ensure that before they spread information, it is properly checked and verified. The problem with social media is none of that happens. We're also meeting the challenges in a number of other areas which have been referred to. Facial recognition software is now becoming ubiquitous. It has benefits. My colleague in government who is responsible for policing is really keen on it. He sees a world where anybody who has a conviction for shoplifting, they will be instantly recognised when they come into a shop and they can be banned. It raises privacy issues. But, you know, there are benefits for law enforcement too, in spotting convicted criminals, finding people, but we need to have clear rules of engagement. Autonomous decision making. So I took a bill through our parliament which looked at how we protect people who are subject to autonomous decision making, particularly in the area of recruitment, where there may be algorithmic discrimination or bias, where people can find that they get a job or don't get a job because somehow they've fallen foul of the algorithm. That is something which we need to put a protection against, and ultimately we said that anybody who is subject to autonomous decision-making needs to have a right of appeal to a human who will actually look at why the machine has reached the decision it has. The other area which again was touched on this morning, which is horrible, is the way in which AI can be used for the manufacture of child pornography, or indeed another one we've been dealing with, which is revenge pornography. Angry ex-boyfriends who use AI to create pornographic images of their former girlfriend and then spread them through the internet. We are passing specific laws against that, and obviously child pornography is already illegal, but we need to extend that so that the law takes account of child pornography or indeed exchanges online with a machine purporting to be a child, which are the equivalent of a real person. So all of these are measures which I think Parliament does have a role to play in, but they are specific areas, and we mustn't do anything to prevent innovation in what is one of the most exciting developments, certainly, I will ever see. I leave you with one thought. I was lucky enough to attend the conversation which took place between my Prime Minister and Elon Musk a year ago at the beginning of the AI Safety Summit. And Elon Musk, who has a graphic turn of phrase, says this is the end of work. There will be no more jobs. His actual quote was, "No job is needed. You can have a job if you want one for personal satisfaction, but AI will do everything." Now, I don't know if we've quite got to that. I did, before sitting down this afternoon, just say to my ChatGPT and co-pilot, write me a speech on parliamentary regulation of artificial intelligence. I can tell you it was very good. It's probably better than one I've just given. And what's more, if I'd asked it, it could have written it and then delivered it in my voice in Portuguese. So I'm afraid the interpreters may find a bit of a threat there too. This is a totally different world. It is really exciting. It brings enormous benefits, but we need to be aware of the challenges as well. And that's why I think today has been really valuable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear John. Thank you for sharing your personal experience with us. And think this is what we are looking for, particularly to learn more about our national delegations, the experience that you have so far. So thank you very much again. Now I'd like to open the debate, and please raise your hand if you want to make some intervention or raise some question to our esteemed speakers. So it means that everything is clear. Yeah, but maybe you have a time to sing, but I want to give one question to both to all of our speakers. First question is to Dr. Zorinham. You have mentioned about the European Parliament's initiative, and you have just elaborated the EU perspective, how we should deal with that issue, and also Madame Suna also has pointed out the Council of Europe's recently adopted treaty on AI. More or less, it is understandable that both of our, guest speakers have a great concern and also wanted to share with the OECP members. But the question is, what is the main difference between the approaches of EU and the Council of Europe in tackling this issue? Because we are talking about the national experience, we are talking about the role of the national parliaments in tackling these issues. And also, it is very much important for the member countries to know what is the general, approach of the organization that we are the member, and how we really need to go, because it is a long way to go together. And my question also to John, because John, you have mentioned that about the rapidly developing IT technology, it is not easy for us to catch and to be in line with the level of development or the rapidness. And also, you have also put the question that on one hand we have to support the technology technological revolution, on the other hand we have to make sure that the security is in place. So do you think that is that a dilemma between two, let's say, main phenomena? Or I think what should be first, how the United Kingdom experience tell us, because based on your own experience, you have already done something for that reason. So what could you recommend us? Because I think it would be ideally a sort of, the model law or model or regulation for, the countries that needs to be discussed. Because as I said, there is a long way to go together. We cannot say, okay, this is a particular law or regulation is applicable to each of us. So it means that we need to discuss it further literally, and we have to make sure that this is really the thing that we are looking for, and it could be applicable, it could be helpful for all of us, because it doesn't recognize any border, any frontiers. So it is a global issue, and this is why, in order to have a concrete result, the global approach is required. So maybe we start, Dr. Zaroma, what is the main difference of the EU and the Council of Europe's approach to that issue? Maybe.
Thank you very much. I will use now perhaps the possibility to speak in my own language.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the three speakers that we heard. It is clear that we all trying to look for solutions, for sure, which will allow to benefit us to the utmost of the new technologies, trying to avoid the risks that they pose. And as it was summarized by Lord John, to try to regulate without limiting or breaking the evolution or the development. How do we do from a parliament of a country which is member of the EU or the European Parliament? Well, we have a fundamental value which is part of the European identity, which is humanism and individual freedom, the individual right to its own data. And that makes a difference. Because, as you know, data is the fuel of the technological development. Data is the fuel of all the apps and all of implementations and developments. And we have to ensure that the data that we are gathering to be that allow us to develop are data that people are willing to give up. It was very complicated to reach an agreement. Like I said before, I was the reporter of MEA or DMEA, opting out, for example, concerning information. And the last ruling to which I was part as a negotiator, as a shadow rapporteur of the Social Democrats, SND, was the data in health sector within the European Union. This question is determined, and how many of my colleagues, namely those from Freedom and Guarantees, were against this option of opting out, that every data should be allowed expressly by each individual person, even in anonymity, and that creates a differential, a huge in terms of ability to innovate in the EU, and also has a negative impact for the patients and for the health services to be able to give answers based on technology and to be able to reach more people. But this balance is very difficult to reach. And within the EU, we tried to base ourselves in this fundamental principle. And I come to an end saying that regulation has not technological, has to be based on this value, neutrality, based on people, based on their consent and their own control. This is the difference, and this is the difficult, but it can also be the big advantage. The question is simple. As a European legislator, either our vision wins and we'll be in the forefront of the fight for development. If we lose, then we'll be in not well, but we still have a long way to go, certainly. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Zorina. And now I'd like to ask, maybe I just reshape my question a bit, because you have mentioned that in the treaty that Council of Europe has adopted, some positive aspects of AI is missing. Mm. And also you have mentioned that it doesn't address the ownership of AI, which is very important point, because without identifying that, it would be a bit difficult for us to address all the issues. So my question is, it is a legally binding first ever adopted treaty by the Council of Europe. If you recommend to the member of countries with such a gaps, how it is going to be an effective tool for the national, for the countries, for the national assemblies or parliaments. So maybe you can give some, a bit explanation, what is your perspective of adopting or of joining the member country to that treaty, and how really Council of Europe is going to, if it is necessary to update or to make some follow-up activities in the coming future. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that question. I still think that joining or signing, accessing to this framework convention is extremely important and a very important first step towards this universal regulation that we've been talking about here today. Standardization of how we approach the risks and benefits of AI. So, yes, it doesn't address the positive uses, as in it doesn't oblige the member states to use AI for this or that positive outcome. But what it does do is set certain standards. Now, I wanted to answer your original question about the difference between the two treaties or the two regulatory frameworks. So, first of all, of course, the European Union has a much stronger regulatory standpoint in the sense that it becomes directly applicable in all of the European Union. So their AI Act will be transposed into the national legislations of all EU member states, no exceptions or things like that. So in that sense, you could say that it has a stronger legal basis. What the treaty does is that it is an international legally binding framework convention. So it is intended to be a framework around the regulation of AI within the national parliaments that
sign up to it, you know. So, and the EU, just to note, is going to be, as far as I understand, and was part of the negotiations, a signatory. So, in that sense, what our treaty offers is that it's a global instrument that has a much wider reach than the European Union, in the sense that the EU has, significantly less member states than the Council of Europe to begin with. And then, on top of that, we had a lot of outside of Council of Europe actors with us as well, like the United States and some South American countries and Japan, just to name a few examples. So. What is also important is, you know, this distinguishment. There are these formalistic differences that I was mentioning, the number of states, the kind of instrument it is, but then there's also the content. And when it comes to the content, there's a lot of similarities in this approach that we have, you know, this human-centric approach. Ours, we say it's based on the values of the Council of Europe. In the EU, they talk about, you know, risk assessment, which we also talk about. So we have similar approaches to the same issue, but it's of course just different instruments, and it belongs to different bodies. But what I think is a significant factor here is that the EU is going to be a member of this treaty. So I would definitely encourage everybody to sign up. And it still leaves us with a lot of room to improve these opportunities for growth, as I called them, because we do need to address ownership of AI systems. And it's like I said before earlier when I was asking a question here, it's the elephant in the room. The fact that these business models that social media companies work on, they're mining our data to manipulate us to sell advertisements in a completely transparent way, in a way that has been described very adequately as surveillance capitalism. And we're allowing this model that disinforms our citizenry, that abuses our time and effort and literacy to nefarious ends, to just happen. Because we've just allowed ourselves to become part of it and are not really addressing it very thoroughly. And some significant changes in our approach to intellectual property, to property in general, have to happen because do we really want the Elon Musks of this world to be the sole owners of authority in the world? Because if we don't regulate companies like X, so aptly named now, or Facebook, or whatever it is, we will end up there. We will end up with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and guys like that running this world. And we will have inequality far beyond our wildest dreams in terms of, you know, just the abject poverty that we will witness if we don't do something about the ownership and the right to benefit from these advancements. So this is something where we have an opportunity to grow, and we can still add it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear Suna. I think, yeah, it is a question and the topic that we need to discuss further on. And of course, there are other questions. I don't want to take a time. If any of our colleagues still wishes to take a floor, please feel free. Yevgeny, but before Yevgeny, because I asked a question to John about the experience that our good friend has regarding the upgrade, the following up or updating the regulations in light of rapid development of AI, and what is the main challenges? Of course, you mentioned about that, but maybe you can give some example or some case if you have faced so far, and also what's your recommendation, because you are the only one who represent the national delegation here. I think it would be great for us to know how we can jointly combine our common efforts in order to be more effective in that era and in that issue, and the UK experience. What has UK experience on that? So John, please.
Well, every country is developing its own. I mean, we've heard about the EU's regulatory framework and the Council of Europe. My country is a signatory of Council of Europe, no longer in the EU. But equally, you know, the biggest players are in America. We've seen the executive order produced by the president. But the second biggest player in this is China. And we had a long debate about when we set up the AI Safety Summit about whether or not to invite the Chinese, because they don't share our values, you know, all the things which we take for granted, like human rights and civil liberties. They take a different view, but equally they are very powerful players. So there needs to be agreement on the basic safeguards, and actually the people who are most likely to deliver those are the companies. You know, it's not governments who are developing this technology. It is Google, and it is Meta, and it is Amazon. I was in Korea 2 weeks ago, where Naver, who most people won't have heard of Naver, but they are the South Korean Google. They have compute powers almost on a par with Google. So it needs to be on a global basis. And that is what the AI Safety Summit is all about. But I do believe that, you know, governments need to set clear guidelines about what we expect from companies, but we mustn't hold back innovation from taking place, because actually that is overwhelmingly going to be a positive.
Thank you very much, dear John. Now I'd like to give the floor to our friend from Italy, Evgenia, please, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, grazie. Grazie Presidente, grazie, grazie Zai, grazie colleghi.
Thank you for this opportunity to debate. And I'd like to thank from the bottom of our heart the Portuguese delegation for the hospitality. Thank you very much, and on behalf of the Italian delegation. Italy believes on artificial intelligence. We follow closely, and we heard what the colleagues, the previous speakers, and I'd like only to share with you some reflections concerning future. We have to invest in the future because we are submerged, or we are living in a world in which we have to react, and we also have to act. And artificial intelligence, AI, is one of those perspectives. It's an imperative. AI is part of our present and will be part of our future. We should not be scared by AI, because the human will not be replaced by algorithms, in our view. So we have to take into consideration the human dimension, the safety relationships, and the issues related to legality between us. So there are many areas of scientific research, progress, and well-being for the populations. And so everything that was said today here in this room is, all the ideas are interlinked in a world which has a meaning. And what meaning do we want to give to AI? Intelligence is to see things more deeply, and no machine will replace man or woman. So it's also true that we need to define a framework with rules, with laws, which will allow us to use appropriately AI. We have to rule AI in terms, in legal terms, developing this technology, AI, based on the human potential. We have to invest in AI, we have to bet on AI, and we have to ensure equal access to instruments based on AI for all countries. And I'm, of course, referring to those countries which are member of our organization. But also, I'm referring to technologies in general, but not just the technology based on AI. So we need to implement necessary infrastructures. First of all, the 5G network. We know that China is developing already a reinforcement of connection to 6G, not just 5, 6G. So I'm not here questioning what we need to do, but the truth is the parliament, or the parliaments or national parliaments, are the ideal forum to debate these matters. So as a representative in my country and fight against organized crime, I'd like to say that we have to build a paradigm which allows us to manage all the systems based on AI. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, dear Evgenia. You have raised... Okay, please. Your lady from... Yeah, you want... No. Okay, you just raised your hand. That's why I just... Okay, so Evgenia, you have raised a very important question, whether we should be in line with all this, you know, geopolitical competition or not. You have spoken about the Chinese, U.S. and the EU competition that also Dr. Zorin also mentioned about that. This is the main question. This is the main question, but the question is, as John rightly mentioned before, that there is a great need for cooperation, global cooperation. So, of course, if we put this, you know, on the topic of our national interests only, of course, the globally we will use, and it will become more and more difficult. So you want to add something, please?
Yeah, if I could just quickly respond. I mean, it's true that a machine will never physically replace a man or a woman, but it depends on what you mean with replace, because the current prediction is that about 40% of current jobs are at risk of being taken over by AI. Now imagine if 40% of your population within a short period of time lost their jobs to AI. What would you do for that population? Where are you going to send them? Where are they going to work? We need to rethink our entire societal system because of these developments. We can't just stop looking the other way and talk about the amazing opportunities of AI, but not look at the costs, which are massive societal displacement. And if we continue to look away from the issue of ownership and the right to benefit from these advancements and allow a very select few to gather insane amounts of wealth based on this technology and leaving, let's say it's only the 40%, let's say that this is a correct prediction and that it won't exponentially grow like everything in the sector has been exponentially growing, still 40% of the workforce in the dust without a job and therefore without a reliable income. Where are we going to go with that? We really do need to address the main issue, which is who gets to benefit. It should be our societies. It shouldn't be the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses of the world. And for that, we have to ask the fundamental question, are we really served with our current model on intellectual property and property rights in general? We have to look at it now, because this is the time to ensure that we don't have some dystopian future ahead of us.
Yeah, thank you. And I saw our friend from Italy, Emmanuel, wants to take a floor. Please, Emmanuel.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you to all of you for the conversation that you just said. We can say that I'm coming out optimistic, but we know that we have to do a hard job as a member, as parliamentarians, because artificial intelligence obviously is there. We have to face it, we have to drive it. Can be positive for our countries, but we have to drive on it also, because manipulation of information, it is something that can be really dangerous. Just think that on the election can be manipulation of the information also during the election can be really dangerous. Just think that during this year, almost 51% of the people will go to vote in the world. So that is the reason why we really have to drive. And again, as CCT members, that was the reason why we made this kind of a resolution with is like a frame. But I'm curious, and I just want to take this opportunity to have you. I'm curious because if I think to artificial intelligence, I think about something quick, immediate. But on the other hand, who has to legislate, to make the rules, the parliamentarians, the parliaments, is not that fast. So, like, I would like to have like a suggestion how to allow the parliamentarians and the parliaments to be as quick as the artificial intelligence is in growing and changing. Thank you.
This is really a good question, but who is going to answer this question? Please, Sana.
You, sir?
I mean, you pose a very relevant question. If we look at the, what do we call it, that diaspora of parliamentarians all over the world, what we need to do is address digital literacy in parliaments. And being a member of parliament myself, I can say that most of my colleagues are older than me and less digitally literate than me. So it is an uphill battle to get parliamentarians to the level of understanding that they need to be able to address these challenges in any significant kind of way. That's, you know, the number one challenge is just for legislators to understand what it's all about and what it can mean. And the older a legislative is, I don't mean to sound ageist, it's just that they haven't grown up with the technologies like the younger generations have. So it's an uphill battle to just reach a level of awareness and know-how to be able to address it in the first place. And the reason why it's so important that we speed up and we get better and we get more agile and actually use, you know, the same type of developmental attitude towards like legislating AI as the AI companies use themselves, and I'm referring here to Agile, for example, is that you know, the companies are way ahead of us in determining the rules of engagement with all of these machines. Because we haven't been there to regulate it, it's them who get to decide it. And there's this classical dilemma, I'll leave you with one example, is, you know, the automated cars that we were all expected to be driving by now, or not driving, so to speak, is that, you know, if you allow Google or whoever it is that is manufacturing these automated vehicles to determine the rules of engagement of the automated car, and the car is faced with a child on the road, and it has to brake and therewith endanger the life of the driver, or continue driving and endanger the life of the child, but save the driver. What will a private company, based on the income from its customers, choose if it doesn't have any regulation telling it to make the ethical choice? It will make the right business choice, won't it? It'll protect its investment. So the reason we need to be there to regulate is because we cannot let entities that has their main purpose to make profit determine what the rules of engagement are with the machines that we let them introduce to our world. And this is why we need to speed up.
Thank you very much. But before giving the floor to our other guest speakers, but I want to also take one last question from audience, our friend from Germany, Malte, wants to take the floor. So please, Malte.
Yes, I just want to mention, because you said that a large percentage of workers will be de-employed because of the AI, but on the other hand, we have a lot of new opportunities in plenty of sectors for new job opportunities, and in times of the lack of skilled workers in many countries, I think this is also something that we can positively look upon. So my question is, what do you think, in which sectors will AI generate new job opportunities? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Maybe Dr. Sorinia, you also just covered this question.
Thank you very much. Only three very, very quick comments. The first about the question raised by Lord John Whittingall about how to put the enterprises, make auto-regulation. This is a very important question. The solution we try to put in work in the European Union is the idea that the fox need to maintain the chicken in the place, because if the, all the chicken is hit, the fox also dead with hungry. So it's the principle of the MEA, it's the principle of the SEA. And I think it's a good principle that is working. You make some 1 month ago, the first 1 year report of monitoring. You are a lot of processes now between European Union and the Big Six and other enterprises, but you know, you have this principle of eight keepers is working till now, and is one of the possible approaches. The second note about the question of alignment, you are now the foreign minister of Portugal, the foreign affairs minister of Portugal. My former colleague in the European Parliament, Paulo Rangel, perhaps now he could hear me. And this question of alignment is perhaps a very good question for him, because how to align, we need to align global solutions for that. You need to align also with China, but which will be the headlines? For me, the headlines is imagination. Till now, imagination is one point, it is headline. The second headline is the right to have own meanings, is the right of meaning. This is, but it's very difficult, it's a very crucial issue. About the improved regulation when technology changes all days, we need a new kind of quantic regulation that improves automatically under human control. It's easy to do, no, but you need to try. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I want to give the floor to Mr. Whittingdale for his maybe last remark.
Thanks. It may be that 40% of jobs are replaced by AI, but that I don't think is something that we should be frightened of. I think it will need for us to readjust what we expect, and actually it offers opportunities for people to have much more leisure time and not to have the drudgery of a lot of jobs which will be replaced by AI. Where I disagree is that, I mean, all these advances are coming out of private sector companies. Government obviously has a job to do to ensure that regulation is in place to ensure that it isn't abused. But these are being driven by, you know, major tech companies who have changed the world. And, you know, if you imagine a world without the internet, without Google, I mean, it seems backward, and yet it's only in the last few years. And all of that has come free, which is another reason why, and I don't regard advertising as something which we should be concerned about. It has brought enormous benefits. The fact that we can do so much through smart technology like, you know, Google Maps or Google Translate or searches on the internet, all of that you don't pay for. It's paid for by advertising, but it is hugely beneficial. And I don't share this worry about, you know, the evils of Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. I think governments are much more dangerous than individuals. And the idea that Google is going to somehow choose to have its car run over a child because it's worried that the driver might be affected, I just think it is nonsense. I mean, obviously, Google is going to be affected if their cars hit a child as much as if the driver's hurt. We need to put in place basic guidelines. But the idea that government either could or should lay down detailed regulation about the operation of these companies will hold them back, and actually will hand over to those who have much less beneficial motives, who, as we've already heard earlier, are equally developing this technology very fast.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Dear colleagues, indeed, I'd like to thank all our guest speakers for their availability and also for their interesting presentation. And that I do believe that this is not the end of our discussions, because this is the topic that really we need to keep on the agenda of our assembly. But of course, we have to find other tools and the possibility, and maybe some structure or some, you know, to increase our institutional capacity as the Parliamentary Assembly. But I'd like to just remind you that upon the initiative of our president, Pierre Kama, we have had a second round or second time of the discussion about the future of the OEC Parliamentary Assembly. We have thoroughly discussed the possible way and the best way of the assembly to go on. And one of the ideas was maybe to look at the structure of the Parliamentary Assembly and to put some, let's say, something new that really, let's say, covers our daily life, which one of them was the artificial intelligence. So, Pierre, maybe you and Roberto, of course, in the coming, upcoming events or in Bucharest, we can also discuss. Maybe one of the ideas could be, as we discussed in Copenhagen last April, to have a subcommittee on artificial intelligence within the second the committee, general committee, because it is really, as today's discussion proves once more, that this is a very challenging issue. This is a very important issue. We shouldn't just discuss it in one case, but it is really need to be on the high agenda of the assembly. By saying that, of course, I'd like once more thank our host and our Portuguese friends, Paula and Luis and the others, and of course the leadership of the Parliamentary Assembly, as well as our friends, colleagues who made such a long distance to come here, and of course our International Secretariat, Roberta, and the good friend Marco, others who really made great efforts to make this conference possible. Thank you very much. By that, I'm closing the last session. And I want to, again, thank our guest speakers. Thank you. So we will have a closing session soon.
Yeah. Muito boa tarde a todos. Nós vamos dar.
Good afternoon. We are now going to start the closing session and try to make it short. We all want to go back home. And I'm sure we also want first to go to Casa do Alentejo for dinner. I shall speak in English because that is the language. As a member of this organization, we do our presentations. Vou começar.
Thank you to everyone who came to Lisbon for the second conference, the first of this new stage, which we hope was fruitful and left everyone waiting to return. I would like to thank, on behalf of the Portuguese delegation at APOs of Paula Cardoso and myself, and I believe if the Vice President of Parliament has mine in his name too, of the Portuguese Parliament, all the support, confidence and friendship from President Pia Calma, but also from the Secretary General Roberto Montella, with whom, still in Birmingham back in 2022, we began to prepare this initiative and holding in Portugal the annual meeting, which will take place next year in Oporto. If I may, umas pequenas palavras também para os funcionários da Assembleia.
Now, a few words to the staff of the Parliament for all your efforts during this month and for nothing to be missing to any of the MPs, to any of the members of the OSH PA.
The sea voyages that started right here in Lisbon, we changed the way of thinking. Centuries later, energy, first the coal, then electricity, allowed the Industrial Revolution that changed not only the economy and social organization, but the rules of thought. Then the internet. And we made the voyages again without going out of our rooms back at home. And now, the artificial intelligence. We may be well, we'll be on the incoming of a new time for human development. The potential of artificial intelligence to substantially change our lives is tremendous. The range of application is quite wide, from advances in environment, science, and decarbonization to cybersecurity, war weapons, and new medicines. As we have seen through the day, measures are needed to strengthen the safety and security of artificial intelligence, protect the privacy of citizens, increase safeguards, promote equity and fundamental rights, defend consumers and defend workers and employers, promote innovation and competition, guarantee democracy, human rights. We need to regulate the use of artificial intelligence, but at the same time, we need to not be afraid of change and invest in innovation and the transfer of knowledge from universities to companies. There are so many applications and opportunities. And conversely, Europe's rule is weak compared to America and China in terms of research and production of new patents. We therefore need to support the development of artificial intelligence in Europe and regulate its current use. There are no bad technologies, only bad uses for the technology. As we are talking about future along this day, allow me to go back to the past. In 1755, a huge earthquake destroyed Lisbon. In fact, destroyed Lisbon and half of Portugal. This natural event was so devastating that it shook European thought itself. Too linear and too full of religions, explanations to interpret what happened or to interpret the unknown. One of our speakers this morning turned to speak about Sun Tzu and the War of War. My dear friend, Carlos Jorim quoted a popular poet from my land, Algarve. I should return the friendship and quote Abad Correia da Serra, but I choose another one. I choose to quote Voltaire with a little book he wrote 4 years after the earthquake, inspired himself by the earthquake, a Lisbon earthquake. He called him Candide or the Optimist. That short book portrays the abrupt interruption of a lifestyle, a way of thinking and acting, and the beginning of what we call the century of light. It ends with a challenge. We must cultivate our garden. Cultivating the garden is taking on the civilizing task. Cultivating is the work of civilization. Cultivating is caring, helping, supporting others. Cultivating is the verb for human rights, for human development. As politicians, as members of parliament, we know that it is necessary permanently cultivate the garden. That is to face problems with the aim of human rights as a road to put artificial intelligence at the service of human beings so that the world can gradually improve. Or at least, well, at least for those who don't live permanently in Lisbon, don't get worse. Returning to Voltaire in his book, I hope we took the inspiration and the tools to once back in our national parliaments, create the political environment to get the world improved and to let better than we found it. Thank you very much to come to Lisbon. It's my honor now to give the stage to our General Secretary, Roberto Montella. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Luis. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Minister, Vice President, Madam President, thank you very much for this event. Paola, I would like to thank you in particular. I would like to thank your staff, Anna Margarita, Nuno, all those who have worked on this conference, the colleagues in the OEC Parliamentary Assembly, Marco, Dario, all of those who have worked on this. I know many people have thanked you, but I think now that we are in the conclusion, we actually have to thank you, and to thank Portugal in particular. Portugal has been playing a key role in our Assembly. You've had this morning the visit of a former president, João Soares, who was our president for many years. We had two vice presidents from Portugal, Isabel Santos and Ilza de Sena. We have leaders of Portugal who have been very active in the Parliamentary Assembly. I think Portugal plays an important role. Next year, it's been said, you're going to host the biggest event. It's the biggest contribution that you can do, give to the Parliamentary Assembly, hosting an annual session in Porto next year. And these Lisbon conferences, I mean, now you have in the logo, it's becoming a tradition. And I must say, I have participated in many sessions of the Parliamentary Assembly. And this type of conferences, like the one we had in Landsweiler a few weeks ago, or in Cyprus on corruption a few years ago, they become more and more the center where really good debate, good discussions on issues can take place. Normally, in our statutory meetings, in our official meetings, we are very much driven by the protocol that we have. We have to pass resolutions, but we don't have the opportunity to debate freely. And I can see the number of participants. This is, for your information, the biggest event ever participation that is not a non-statutory meeting. So we've never had so much participants in an event which is a non-statutory meeting. The choice of the argument, of course, I will not add any other word on artificial intelligence, one, because I'm not an expert, but two, because I think we've heard from distinguished guests, and I would like to thank all the experts who have taken the floor here. We have really learned a lot, and I think anything that I would add is superfluous, because I think everything has been said. I am proud that the Parliamentary Assembly is giving itself more and more tools to debate key issues that we have. I think in the past years, we've had the capacity to kind of accompany what's happening in the world. We've seen in the last years terrorism become a big issue, and we've given ourselves a tool to deal with terrorism, which is the Committee on Fight Against Terrorism. Migration, we've given ourselves our tool. Climate change, we have a special representative. Now artificial intelligence, so I welcome also the idea that we give ourselves some maybe also organic tools to deal with these central issues so that they are not just debated in the plenary, but more focus is given on them. I think a key key issue is that these issues cannot be dealt by national legislations. And I think it is very good that the Council of Europe has legislated on this, but that also the Parliamentary Assembly understands that we need to have multilateral tools to deal with these challenges. All the big challenges that we have in front of us can only be dealt with members of parliaments, leaders getting together, discussing between themselves and devising solutions to the big challenges that we have together. Also, a word of gratitude to the second committee led by Azai Guliev and Gudrun Kugler this morning was here, although Artur Gerasimov was not here. But the second committee has taken a greater role, also probably with the help of Marco in our secretariat, who gives a boost into focusing on key issues that are on the world's agenda and working on that. So thank you very much also to the second committee. I would leave it with the words of, there is an Italian delegation, a consistent Italian delegation here, and you've probably, the Italians will know better. There is, in these days in Italy, a long debate over a book, The Rule of the Game, that was published by the former head of the Italian counter-espionage, Marco Mancini. And he talks about human intelligence and digital intelligence, and also in the framework of what has happened on the 7th of October in Israel. So I think, and this would be my conclusion, I think that it is very important, of course, to regulate and to promote artificial intelligence. But I'm also a strong, let's say, fan of human intelligence. And I think in some sectors of life, never forget that human intelligence is really the key to make key powerful decisions that depend also on the future of our lives. So while we regulate artificial intelligence, let's, of course, make sure that we preserve and we defend human intelligence, of which I have strong belief in. Thank you very much.
Obrigado, Roberto Montella. Convidava agora a usar da palavra.
Thank you, Roberto Montella. I now give the floor to the Vice President or Deputy Speaker of the Portuguese Parliament, Mr. Pérez Trello. Thank you, Mr. Member of Parliament. I greet all presidents, namely the President of OSCE, Pierre Coleman, Secretary General of the Parliamentary Assembly of OSCE, Mr. Montella, President of the Portuguese delegation to the OSCE PA, and Vice President of the delegation, dear participants, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I first greet the members of the Portuguese delegation of the Parliamentary Assembly of OSCE, namely MPs Paula Cardoso and Luís Graça, President and Vice President of this delegation, for the excellent initiative and for the opportunity of this subject. I also note the excellent contributions brought by remarkable speakers throughout the day that I could attend through our TV channel. I'm very happy to participate in the Conference of Lisbon of the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly, an organization I had the privilege to belong as a member of the Portuguese delegation between 2005 and 2007. In that capacity, I followed and contributed to the works of the OSCE AP, PA, in the promotion of a greater involvement of national parliaments in the OSCE, and I enhanced the work to develop the promotion of prevention, conflict prevention and resolution mechanisms, as well as the supporting and strengthened the democratic institutions in the member states. The work developed, namely through the election observation missions, is an important contribution to the strengthening and consolidation of democratic institutions. Now, I'd like to stress here the case of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, to which I currently belong to. In the Parliamentary Assembly of NATO, we have developed an intense work in the consolidation of democratic institutions. That role has been played by the Rosenthal seminars that have already had hundreds of editions with on subjects on the strengthening of democracies, defense and security. It's an important tool to the dialogue and cooperation with parliaments from Central and Eastern Europe that are not members of NATO. No less important has been the work of the Special Group for the Mediterranean and the Middle East. It has been able to sit at the same table parliamentaries from that region where safety issues are known to all of you, and it seems that they are getting worse. Now, I stress under the scope of the Parliamentary Assembly of NATO, a recommendation made by this Assembly towards the creation of a Democratic Resilience Center at NATO as a resource made available to states, the structure of which would coordinate with other organizations issues related to democratic resilience. The parliamentary assemblies are also privileged fora for the debate on the key role that science and technology play in the world today and its impacts on security and prosperity of states and peoples. Now, the subject of today's event, security in the age of artificial intelligence, is of the utmost importance. Artificial intelligence is changing quickly and changes the way how people live and work. The implications and impacts of artificial intelligence are difficult to assess, given its very quick development and the variety of applications. Just think about the applications of AI today, and then look back 5 or 10 years. What an evolution! And imagine, how will it be like in 10 years? It's difficult to imagine. Namely, in the areas of defense and security, a core concern of this organization and also the other one I belong to, the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, applications seem endless, impossible to predict, and of unimaginable consequences, be it in the military field and the non-military field. It can be constructive or destructive. The integration of artificial intelligence brings countless opportunities and benefits in support to the human factor, to improve knowledge on different scenarios and operations, or in the analysis of the different options in terms of strategic decision making. In the areas of defense, there is a potential for development of autonomous systems, contributing to a new paradigm, the role of troops in conflict with artificial intelligence, allowing to carry out extremely destructive missions without putting the soldiers at risk. And also the systems of cyber defense, where artificial intelligence improves the resistance to cyber threats. Now, associated with challenges and opportunities, the application of intelligence, of artificial intelligence, also entails risks and brings ethical and legal challenges, namely as regards the humanitarian international law, the rights of people, and the capacity to generate disruptive disinformation with very strong impacts on different sectors of society, namely the resilience of democratic institutions. Irrespective of the risks and challenges, the growing popularity and wide accessibility of AI is a reality that brings to the need to joint efforts to face these opportunities and challenges it entails through the adoption of regulatory strategies and works and frameworks. Recently, in a conference of parliamentarians, members of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, the vice president of one of the largest technological institutes in the world, when she was asked or faced with questions of ethical, legal, and regulatory nature, she answered was that her institution was of a scientific one. It was not a police or a law enforcement organization or political organizations. I'm not saying what institute all this, because we are working under the Chatham House rules meeting, but a few weeks later, at another university, also a renowned university, ethical and regulatory issues, on the contrary, were at the core of the concerns of academics and researchers. It was comforting to know that not all scientific community is immersed in the Manhattan Project spirit. As parliamentarians, we play a key role in the conception of regulatory frameworks for the development of standards towards an ethic use of AI, monitoring monitoring powers to promote its accountability and also make people aware of its potentialities and risks. Now, all these areas are extremely important. Political areas are very important and urgent in certain international fora, parliamentary fora, just like the parliamentary assemblies. And they are therefore important for the sharing of good practices and sharing of information on common rules towards universally agreed rules that are coherent. I close with a greeting to the participants, members of the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly, and also some of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly that are present here. And I wish that you may still have time to enjoy the history and culture of Lisbon. Thank you.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Deputado Marcos Pestrello.
Thank you, MP Marcos Pestrello, Vice President of the Parliament, Vice President of NATO. Now, to close this conference of the OSCE PA, I give the floor to the Minister of State and Foreign Affairs, Mr. Paulo Rangel. Mr. Deputy Speaker of the Portuguese Parliament, Mr. Marcos Perestrello, Madam President of the Parliamentary Assembly of OSCE, Mr. Pia Kalman, Secretary of State of the Parliamentary Assembly of OSCE, Roberto Montella, President of the Portuguese delegation of the Portuguese Parliament to this Parliamentary Assembly, Mrs. Paula Cardoso, and the Vice President of the delegation, Mr. Luís Graça. Ladies and gentlemen, MPs, ambassadors, ladies and gentlemen.
It, as it is normal in Portuguese, I'd like to tell you that I have a small present for each one of you. I have my book about the English Revolution and the shape of a democratic parliament. That is on Parliament, a very small essay that will be there, is already there, is a blue book, and I hope that at the end of this session you can pick one. I won't sign it because otherwise I could not take care of my functions. It would be very, very, I'd say, long session of signatures. Agradeço muito o convite.
So I thank you for the invitation to participate in the closing of this second Lisbon Conference of the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly. This organization is a unique institution because it is at the same time the largest forum of world security and a core entity in the defense of democracy, human rights, freedom of expression, pluralism, election, free elections and fair elections. I'd like to stress the Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights that plays an extremely relevant role, I would say a replaceable role, in the election observation missions, in the analysis of the elections legislation, and in counseling, development, and maintenance of democratic institutions. I would even say that OSCE has established and consolidated the international standards for free and fair elections, democracies, transitions towards democracy, prevention of a moving towards autocracy. All this is a direct and objective result of the OSCE work. In July 2009 until this April 2024, I was a member of the European Parliament, and from March 2005 to 2009, an MP to the Portuguese Parliament. Because of all this, I have had 20 years of parliamentary activity, non-stop, 15 of these years in a multinational parliament, first with another 26, and with another 27, and finally with another 26 nationalities. This experience allows me to have a privileged understanding, not just of the parliamentary role, but in particular, what we often call
parliamentary diplomacy, the external dimension of the activity of parliaments. Now, elaborating on the basis of this experience I have about the international function of parliaments, namely the platforms, diplomatic, parliamentary diplomacy in, that are so well represented in this parliamentary assembly of the OSCE, one may wonder, what is the what sense does it make to develop international relations between parliaments, or between parliamentary delegations? Don't we all know that, according to the classic classical doctrine of separation of powers, described by John Locke and Montesquieu, that the federative power to John Locke, or the exhaustion of indulgentia by Montesquieu, the power to make peace and war, and to make alliances between political communities, don't we know that this power is an exclusive attribution of the executive power? So does it make any sense to talk about parliamentary diplomacy? If government and sometimes heads of state, the executive branches, if they are the ones that that lead the foreign policy, why open this front to parliaments, to parliamentary delegations? The answer, namely to all democratic regimes, is easy and convincing, because parliaments give a specific contribution to foreign policy. Facing what in classical philosophy and scholastics we call a specific difference. While governments may have a minority or majority support, and they always reflect in the external plan a unique, unified, and indivisible position, translated in the vote of that state in the international bodies that it belongs to, national parliaments, on their hand, are the expression of plurality, internal diversity. I mean, irrespective or notwithstanding the will of the majority that is expressed in parliaments, but they are the contribution that parliaments can bring to the international level is the diversity, plurality of national visions, although represented proportionally in each delegation. National parliaments contribute greatly to the establishment of a true political, international political space and a true international democratic sphere. As a matter of fact, minority positions in a national parliament may correspond to a majority position in another national parliament, and this interaction then leads to a political, international political arena. The votes of a delegation of one state may go to different positions, showing the diversity, plurality, internal plurality of the vision that each state has on the external policy. So there is a true specific difference, a constitutional difference, between the participation of national parliaments in the international and European arenas and the traditional participation of national governments in that same arena. Well, if this contextualization of the diplomatic function of parliaments goes for many organizations, Council of Europe, European Union, NATO, it makes even more sense and is very pertinent in the concrete case of Oche, the European the Parliamentary Assembly of OSCE. If the OSCE is promoting democracy and defending democracy, pluralism, freedom of expression, free and fair elections, if OSCE is an international organization that cares also for pluralism and diversity, then the promoting, enhancing these values can only belong to this organization. And the only way to ensure diversity and pluralism can only be ensured, and it is, by a parliamentary assembly as the one we have here. One last word to associate this doctrinal perspective on the role of parliamentary assembly with the theme of this conference: security in the age of artificial intelligence. At a time when disinformation, hybrid attacks, digital manipulation, cybercrime are growing in all fronts, the democratic process and the security of critical infrastructures have to be protected. The digital world knows no borders. The virtual became universal. Artificial intelligence boosts this digitalization and of our political reality and the political international political reality. On one hand, it gives us tools, instruments to strengthen security in general and the reliability of the election processes and democratic mechanisms. But on the other hand, this artificial intelligence increases the possibilities of threats, disruption of those processes, of those mechanisms, and of the infrastructures that support them and make them work. There is a whole new world, a wonderful new world, as Axel would have said, that requires study, positioning, deliberation, action. Always in the defense of democracy, pluralism, human rights, and security. Hence, democracy, pluralism, human rights, and PAX, security. PAX and TICHA. Always with a plural, diversified, dialectic vision, a network of parliaments in the parliamentary assembly that serves democracy. Only an organization with these democratic values and history can promote in each state and in other states that are not members, promote and uphold democracy. In one word, here, at this parliamentary assembly, international and European democracy is at the service of national democracies. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Paulo Rangel, Minister of State and Foreign Affairs. Dear colleagues, on behalf of our presenter, Pia Colma, we now close this second conference of Lisbon. I hope to see you again soon, and you are all invited for dinner. Thank you.